Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
I'd like to start tonight's discussion really with a bit of a timeline that relates to chair and by showing how powerful artworks in collections, both public and private, have what we can call social lives. They get moved about in the world and they have different relationships with people and spaces and institutions, and they generate different meanings at different moments. Their images disseminate and circulate too, as we'll see. Controversial artworks can quickly become conventional and iconic. So what do we have in chair? Have all of you seen the exhibition? Some of you haven't, but what you'll find in front of you is a collection of images, many of which we'll talk about. So we have a female figure lying on her back, knees pulled up to her breasts, a cushion fixed on the back of her thighs and secured by a belt wrapped around her waist, her calves positioned to form a kind of backrest. She's wearing black leather hot pants and thigh-high leather stiletto boots. She isn't actually a she, but an acrylic painted fiberglass and resin object designed by Alan Jones and made in 1969 with Dick Beach, a freelance sculptor employed by mannequin and waxwork manufacturers, Gems Models. Alan Jones, in making this work, was responding to changing attitudes towards the erotic and women's bodies, attitudes he encountered around his studio in King's Road, an area which was in the late 1960s what he calls a living theater. Jones's chair was not made to be used as a chair. So I think it's good to get those points out. So as I said, I'm going to take you through a timeline mentioning various historic incidents that relate in various ways to this work and the fact that this work was the subject of an attack in 1986. So let's go to 1914. On the 10th of March in 1914, Mary Richardson attacked Diego Velázquez's famous work, The Lippi Venus, which is, I think, the third image in our collection in the National Gallery. She did it as a form of protest against the imprisonment of Emmeline Pankhurst, but the action was also in line with the suffragettes' strategy of attacking national buildings and properties of the state in their campaign for women's votes. Mary Richardson struck the painting several times with a meat chopper, causing deep gashes, and you can see what she did in the following image. She'd chosen the picture deliberately as the most beautiful painting in the world. And she said, "I've tried to destroy the picture of the most beautiful woman in mythological history as a protest against the government for destroying Mrs. Pankhurst, who is the most beautiful character in modern history. Justice is an element of beauty as much as color and outline on canvas. You can get another picture, but you cannot get another life." Later in life, she said what bothered her was the way men visitors gaped at it all day long. So let's go back to 1969. In 1969, the first image of what is now known as a Page 3 glamour model, clothed, appeared in the Sun newspaper, which had been newly relaunched by Rupert Murdoch. By 1970, the model was topless. In 1970, Chair was exhibited at Arthur Tooth & Sons Gallery. The exhibition attracted high praise as well as criticism. In 1973, in Spare Rib, Laura Mulvey assessed Alan Jones's imagery as, quote, "a fetishist image of women, portrayed for men as figures in an amazing masquerade, which expresses a strange male underworld of fear and desire," unquote. A few years later, in 1979, Lisa Tichner discussed his work in terms of the objectification of women's bodies. Then in 1981, when it was acquired by Tate, or what was then the Tate Gallery, Chair was valued for breaking new ground as an anti-canonical depiction of the female form, and one that resonated with pop art's objects of mass production and consumer capitalism, and what was then sexual subculture. On the 4th of March, 1986, a visitor wrote a letter to the director of the Tate Gallery, singling out Chair, which was on display as part of an exhibition called 40 Years of Modern Art, for particular criticism. And she wrote, quote, I found the sculpture deeply offensive to my womanliness and to my sex. As a part-time lecturer in art and design, I feel responsible to react in some way. My immediate response, I wanted to kick it to small pieces and destroy it, was one of great anger that this piece had been selected as something which was revered as a valuable statement of art when it is nothing more than kinky pornography. The obscenity of the piece shows extreme insensitivity towards women, and I would like to see it removed from the exhibition. So that's what was in this letter. And then 4 days later, on the 8th of March, 1986, International Women's Day, two women poured paint stripper over the face of the woman in the sculpture. The damage to the surface of the sculpture, the skin, exposed the polyester resin underneath. Reporting on the incident, newspapers had various things to say, but the Mail on Sunday called the work porn chair. And the attackers were never caught. Moving right along in our timeline, in 1997 to 98, Mima Stelly made Chair, a work in which she photographed herself adopting the pose of the sculpture, wearing the boots but not the shorts. In 2013, Chair appeared in Tate Liverpool's exhibition Glam, the performance of style in a section exploring artifice and eroticism in the early 1970s. Also in 2013, at Frieze Art Fair, Dasha Zukova sat on Bjarne Melgaard's pastiche of Chair, an image which in itself raised issues of race, class, and gender, leading the media to brand Melgaard's work racist Chair. And I mention that just to talk about the ways in which the original work of art has been disseminated, not only through images of the original work, but through other people's responses to it, and then responses to those other people's works. So I'm going to end on what might seem a slightly tangential note, but I came across this last week in The Guardian. It was an article by the screenwriter for the 2002 film Secretary that featured a sexually dominant man and his submissive secretary. And the screenwriter is named Erin Cressida Wilson. And she was describing the challenges that they faced in making this film. She said, no movie star would accept playing the lead in that film. To portray a submissive and to be spanked on screen would be a disastrous move for their careers. This is in 2002. Maggie Gyllenhaal took up the role, and there was criticism about the character, and at one point her character was supposed to find herself and become a lawyer herself, like her boss. She was supposed to be powerful in a way that appeared strong through a traditional feminist lens, but they stuck with the original plot. The screenwriter said, I didn't think this character had a problem at all. I decided that this was a coming-out film for a masochist. And she talks about the film screening at Sundance Film Festival, where she said that middle-aged feminists stomped out during the spanking scene. I'd sit on that bus that shuttled us through the snow between screenings and eavesdrop on conversations. When the subject of Secretary came up, filmgoers would look sideways. No comment. After all, in 2002, educated filmmakers were not supposed to like this sort of thing. They were not supposed to like BDSM. And so we came away from Sundance with an honorable mention and exhaustion. We had not sold the film to a distributor. I had observed other films getting sold for $5 million. It was not a sexy situation. Today it seems that what was pornographic 12 years ago is passé and maybe even cliched. One generation's risque becomes the baseline for the next. So on that note, I'd like to turn to our speakers and have them talk a little bit about their own response to the work. And they've done this a little bit on the RA blog, but I thought we'd just revisit that briefly, and then we'll open up discussion further. Okay?
Eden.
Shall I go first?
Yes.
Well, I mean, the first time I encountered an image of Alan Jones's Chair, I must have been quite young, so I would have still have been at school, so it must have been kind of 18, something like that. And I thought it was alarming and quite shocking, but incredibly interesting. Then when you see the work up close, which I've of course done a lot of recently, and particularly seeing it in the context of the exhibition, it's less shocking, but it's more powerful. What surprised me, actually, when we kind of unpacked it in the galleries, the last time I'd seen it was in a domestic setting, but when I unpacked it in the galleries, it doesn't look as if it was made 40 years ago. It still has that kind of potency, energy. Yes, it's a very strong work.
Thanks. Lindsay, would you like to respond?
You read the blog, but I first saw it because my dad used to take me to the Tate Gallery when I was small, and I suppose when you're quite small you see the things at ground level, so, and you know, the paintings were there, but suddenly there was this amazing beautiful woman, and I of course at that time didn't have any idea about its sort of sexual connotations, so I was just thinking, isn't she pretty and beautiful? And then, you know, and I just thought she was really lovely, actually. And then the next time I saw her, I was a new intern at Tate, and my boss was saying to me, so, Lindsay, you know, so you have to do a project for your internship. You can have this Henry Moore stone reclining figure or this bearded terracotta bust from the 1900s, or you can have this Alan Jones. And he sort of opened the door, and there was the Alan Jones, because actually what we haven't said is that a couple of conservators had already sort of got some of the way there to restoring, and then it sort of one of them had thrown up their hands and said she found it too difficult, and someone else had got a little way, and there she was in this tiny room, and I thought, oh, because I still had that connection with her, so I felt that she looked quite sad. She had no clothes, and she was all, her face was all stripped, and I sort of had quite an emotional reaction and wanted to bring her back. Thanks.
Oh no, not me. I guess my disclaimer is, you know, when I blogged for the Royal Academy website, I had a response from people on certain people on Twitter, and we all know that people say things to provoke or they're fake accounts. But I thought was interesting is somebody said, surely Janusak should have the final say in what Alan Jones's piece is about. And I was like, well, I don't think anybody can have a final say about art, personally, but this is a personal response rather than an expert response. So I'm not sitting here as an expert telling you what I think and how right I am. Alan's work has weaved its way through my professional life, and I've chosen to put myself in it, which you're not going to see images of, thank God. And I worked with Jemima Stelly as well. So that's kind of where I come into it. I think that Alan's work has a huge fashion reference, a media reference. As a consumer, you see him referenced a lot, and I guess that's my remit as well.
That's great. I have some specific questions, but I thought to kick things off, I would let you know what our Twitter feed has brought us in terms of responses, and they're all quite varied. One says, woman as subject, but also objectified. However, do not find it as objectionable as much of today's advertising. So advertising is something that I'd like us to talk about. Danny said, reflexive observation of commodified sex, power, gender. Thought provocative, not offensive.
Okay. It would be really interesting. I know this is not ageist, but it would be really interesting to have people's ages next to, you know, to be like 39. No, I think that one of the things that we were talking about earlier is through time how the piece has, by like my age, I'm 38. I seem to see it in a different way than early feminists, and I think that it's by welcoming the piece you stop becoming a victim. As a feminist. So I think it's really interesting, like we were saying, like having different ages around the room to is it a thing that we've just become used to seeing, so used to seeing images like this everywhere we are that it's no longer shocking or offensive, or is it still shocking and offensive? I think to radical feminist here. Have you got this? Have you guys got this?
No.
There's one here. She's called, I'm assuming it's a woman, Radical Feminist at Radical Feminist is her address. Men degrade and sexually objectify women in BDSM poses and get to call it art, which I don't find that radical as a feminist statement much anymore. I, you know, if you're a radical feminist, I think that's a somewhat dated perception of things.
And I think a response to that is do chip in, everyone, because we've been talking about this before this event, and we could keep going. Another person says, if this depicted a man in S&M regalia as the chair, I doubt a single person would raise the issue of sexism. Art is all about provoking a reaction, and to some delicate souls, this would be deemed offensive, demeaning, and sexist. Because of the obvious BDSM theme here, I think people might assume this piece is about brutality or of female suffering, which in fact would be incorrect. A sexually submissive woman gives herself freely to her partner, i.e. she isn't beaten into submission, it's her own choice. That, to my mind, is empowerment. So we have lots of different views, as I think we have in this room.
Does anybody find it offensive? Yeah.
I do. I can't look at it.
So, and have you come tonight to learn anything new or to tell or to like for us? I mean, I'm sure that
I came because I was interested. I mean, I remember, I maybe sort of vaguely remember the 1980 whatever it was
attack.
Vaguely. And I wondered whether, I know that he's done other work, and I thought it would be interesting, you know, now that I'm older and all of the rest of it, to kind of see how it felt now. But now it's interesting, I can look at the Venus de Rugby, but I can't look at the chair.
And does that go for the other two pieces of sculpture as well? The three of them were done in the same year, the hat stand and the table. Do you find them just as difficult as the chair? Right?
I guess I don't know the one well enough. I mean, the chair is kind of the image which I think is
Well, maybe for his more recent sculptures, which are not, I mean, I think the furniture sculptures are quite atypical because the rest of his figure sculptures are
that's what I've read when I read the exhibition, that there's been a lot of work, and you know, it's possible that these pieces are kind of, I suspect they are of their time and all the rest of it.
Would you find the Rugby Venus offensive if she were wearing high heels in sexy lingerie?
Contemporary lingerie and high heels.
It's the pose and the clothes that the woman is wearing in chair maybe that you find offensive rather than the fact that she's simply naked.
I think it's a position. I don't think it's anything to do with nudity or clothing. Mm-hmm. I think it's because of the way, you know, how she's positioned. But there must be lots of people who've other.
Exactly. Has anyone tried to get into that position? Because it's quite uncomfortable.
If you do yoga, you do it regularly and worse. Yes.
I think it's perhaps the fact that her kind of commodification seems all the more overt because she is furniture. She is called chair, so she's no longer even woman. She's kind of, she becomes a household object that can be bought and that can be. And I think that's probably actually the more jarring thing, perhaps, than, as you say, kind of the nudity or the lingerie we're actually confronted to very often.
But she's not really she's just a bit of fiberglass. Yeah. So she's a dummy and it's an idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's an object.
Yeah.
I don't understand why people get offended by it, because I find it, I think it's very witty. I think it's inventive. Sculpturing, it's a plastic invention, and it actually comments on the things that, like was mentioned before, are much more offensive in advertising that actually go out and permeate all women, all times, and all little girls are looking at those images and thinking that's how they're meant to be. Mm-hmm. You know, this is something quite different in a very different context. And it's not a she.
Exactly.
And it's not a
really
chair
important.
Either.
It's not actually a chair.
It's not a chair and it's not a chair. Mm-hmm. It's not for sitting on.
It's an idea.
I think that's something that's really striking to me in terms of what constitutes her as a she. But when we're talking about kind of patriarchy, or so much of it is power, and within that, especially within the kind of BDSM framework, it's a kind of active and passive. And in that comment, it talks about being submissive. And I think that's the difference between the Jemima Sully, where she's a living, kind of active being, and model, as opposed to the mannequin and the chair. It's just, more of a doll. But,
And I guess Jemima's work, I think she was, as a feminist, trying to, as I feel like, I would buy Alan Jones's work so that I would feel empowered by that, by owning it. I'm like, I've made my stamp, I've made the money, this is feminism to me, I can own that. I think Jemima is owning it in a different way. I think as a female artist in the art world, there is a whole different layer of difficulty of being a feminist, mm-hmm. and B, an artist. Mm-hmm. And this was part of a series that she also put herself in, classically, questionably misogynistic artists like Helmut Newton. But then she also did herself as Francis Bacon, as pieces of work by Francis Bacon. Strangely that she chose Helmut Newton and Alan Jones because I think they're very strong women. They are a vision of a very, like a sort of female warrior in a way.
It's a celebratory.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I feel that they are both. They love women. They don't hate women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that they're a chair kind of accentuates the mundanity to what it's trying to say. Something like the Kagos bronze sculpture is very striking and powerful. Full body of female form, but as a chair, is it not alluding to the mundanity of...
I think one of the things that Alan Jones says that he was reacting against was people's perception of sculpture at the time, because of course figurative sculpture was going through a very interesting period at that time in British art, and the whole concept of the pop artist was to bring the figure back into a kind of central position within the painting, and they all did that to a certain extent, but it was something that Alan continued with when the others were kind of going off in slightly different directions. So the figure was something that he then wanted to bring off the canvas and put it in a central position in sculpture. And when you think at that stage, people like Tony Caro were he was a very dominant figure then. To bring back figurative sculpture, to do it in something that wasn't bronze, to do it in a very non-traditional pose, was quite a radical thing to do. He deliberately put these models in the form of furniture so that he was bringing it away from that concept of the fine art. It was to do with action, it was to do with sitting. It was trying to encourage the viewer to bring a different set of reactions towards the sculpture, which artistically was a brave thing to do, and he knew he was being brave at the time. He didn't expect the feminist backlash to happen. That was something that was a surprise to him at the time.
Yeah, I think he was massively trying to rattle the bars of this art establishment
Because he was expelled from the Royal Academy, wasn't he? So it feels as if it's a piece definitely trying to cause an effect, but not within the community of women that later caused such an effect.
He
wasn't thinking of that, I don't think, when he made it.
Well, he talks about he wanted to offend the art establishment, but in the process he offended the feminist movement, and his timing was you could say it was terrible, actually, because you just had the very strong second wave of feminism coming through when he first showed his works in 1970, and that was something that he had to deal with, and I think it was very difficult for him at the time.
Mm. I mean, 1976, it was based on the King's Road, and 1976 you've got Westwood and the punk movement and bondage trousers, and that's all happening on the King's Road as well. And again, I guess the shocking headlines of punk, of things trying to move the establishment, of trying to be anarchic, that kind of sits with art and life going on as well.
Mm. I think you're right. I mean, he does talk about walking down the King's Road during those years and just seeing ever-increasing... people exploring fashion in remarkable ways, and clothes becoming more clinging and less present, and all of those things. So he was witnessing.
Westwood's shop was, and McLaren's shop was called Sex, and they sold bondage suits and bondage trousers, and the female staff who worked there dressed in this kind of in underwear and bondage gear as their choice.
But the bondage gear is something, it was a very interesting choice for Alan to make, and I spoke to him quite recently actually about how he, why he chose that, and he said, well, I wanted to show the figure, and it was clear from fetish magazines and adult comics that, you know, that sort of clothing really showed up the female form, which I wanted to do. He also said, I was also conscious that I didn't want to dress them in the clothes of the time, even though they look very of the moment. He said, I didn't want to do that. What's quite interesting, what I kind of put to him is, did he know that fetish clothes weren't going to date in the way that any other clothing you can think of would be dated now? And had he put the models in a Bieber dress, they'd look like a Dwayne Hanson piece. Mm-hmm. But he didn't. He put them in fetish clothing, and they still look just as current today as they did 40 years ago. And he said, well, no, I didn't know that, but of course it's, you know, it's true.
An instant reference, isn't it? And I mean, there were other people doing that sort of real figure thing, like Dwayne Hanson
and
Ed Keenholtz and people
right,
like that, but I think he was really trying to step away. And so this as well, I think, in sculpture, this whole idea of this very super real, which later, you know, Jeff Koons and people really sort of carried on, and Ron Mueck with his amazing super real figures, I think that's a massive strand in sculpture that he was actually at the vanguard of. And I mean, in a way, this issue has kind of clouded that as well, I think, you know, so it's a bit of a shame.
I mean, she's on a rug. he cares for her, you know, she's not uncomfortable.
I had to go and buy the rug for the Tate's one because she'd lost a rug. And he was very distinct about the fact that she should have a rug, because talking of the super real, he said otherwise her hands look like these hands of a dummy on the floor.
They
look
a bit slightly sink into the rug, don't they?
Yes,
and
they
she's
look
not
more real.
Really supposed to be in a plinth. He didn't want her in a plinth. Yeah. We have to for the show.
The plinth,
yeah, that's why they made a connection with the floor.
And yeah, at the time, fetish clothing is part of a subculture that wasn't known about. And when I think about it, I'm guessing
that Alan, as an artist, would have been part of a privy to those subcultures, not the Cynthia Payne sort of, suburban sort of sex clubs, but I'm guessing it. And this was happening. This is what everybody else was kind of doing.
But I think it came very much out of pop art. You know, that he became very interested, like they all did, in advertising. He became very interested in the figure in advertising. Of course, you know, Palazzi and Hamilton were as well. And when he went to America, he was amazed, you know, because it's 1960s, Britain was, you know, quite dingy compared to America, everything seemed brighter and bigger, and he was amazed at the advertising there, and he loved the mail order catalogues with women's underwear, and, you know, loved looking at all of that and loved the imagery. And it was actually David Hockney who pointed out to Alan in about 1964 that Alan's drawings at that time, he was doing a lot of those hermaphrodite works with the male and female figure fusing together, they reminded David of adult comics. And Alan started to look at these adult comics and said, yeah, actually, you know, there's a real kind of, you know, there's that very strong line, he loved the imagery, and he was off, and he started collecting loads of those magazines. So that's how he got into that area.
There was also John Sutcliffe, I think, who did a lot of the leather pieces. I mean, he was also working on the Emma Peel
suit,
the ultimate power leather suit, and Barbarella at the same
time.
Well,
if you look at what was happening in fashion with Courrèges, with the miniskirt, with op art, and metal dresses, I mean, they don't exactly look comfortable, but, you know, I made a parallel with, you know, fashion as a strict mistress. You know, if you subscribe to the pain, which is constantly changing, spending all your money on clothes every season, and particularly uncomfortable clothes, there is this strict mistress, which I think with the commercial references that he makes, and then the full circle that he's gone with the new Kate Moss pieces, I think that there is, he's also a cultural sponge. As an artist, he's showing us as a reflection of what's going on in a collective mind as well.
No, I think that's right. And Lindsay mentioned Emma Peel, and he's always been very, very interested in film and photography, and that's something that he's always, and in fact that feeds into his work, you know, with his storyboarding as well. That's very present.
And he contributed to Clockwork Orange.
He did, indeed.
Sorry, I'm not looking properly.
I grew up, went to school, and there was a girl in front of me, and she was 10 years old, and I was 10 years old, and she had ringlets, and we're talking about the 40s, and she would draw with an Alan Jones wonderful stiletto, and then go up the leg and make those wonderful legs. She was obsessed with women's legs. And then she put the dress on, or the bathing suit, usually a two-piece or something. And what I'm thinking about these is nobody said anything about the superficiality of them and the triviality of them, because these women are kind of a little bit fake, but they're so pretty. Just imagine, I love them. Just imagine if they were done by that little guy that does the little men with the realistic, you know, Joe Mork, is it? Mork?
Even
Rodin, or even Jenny Saville, or any of them that did warts and all type of sculptures. It would be horrific, wouldn't it?
Well, isn't that what that is?
Hairy legs and all that.
Oh. Jemima didn't wax her vagina to do this.
What?
So she did this piece, and she was unwaxed, hairy armpits, hairy vagina, you know, so she didn't. So what you're saying is possibly that's quite disgusting.
But this is a real one.
Well, that she's real. That's a real.
Yeah.
No, I'm talking about sculptures only. That I think they're pretty, and the hell with feminism. That they're useful and pretty, but they would be horrible if they were done by other sculptors. Alan Jones makes them acceptable. Just like they're mannequins.
Did you see the Paul McCartney pieces in the Human Factor in the Haywood?
Not yet.
Yes.
They were wax vaginas.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Yeah,
super real thing
too. I mean, I think that also it raises the point: if this was made by a woman, would we even be sitting around talking about it?
Probably not.
Mm. And there are female photographers. Like Ellen von Unworth is a prolific fashion photographer, and she mostly shoots only women, sexualized women. And as a feminist, I don't accept that as a, you know, that's a feminist statement. I find she objectifies women just as much as men do. So I don't think it's a particularly strong feminist argument anyway.
But a lot of people that I know in my generation are refusing to come to this exhibition because they're absolutely disgusted with Alan Jones. So ridiculous, isn't it? Crazy. But they won't come.
Have they seen? Do you think they've seen much? I mean, because to me, people get disgusted at a distance. I feel that happens quite often with shows I've been involved in, and people go off and talk and go, "Oh, it's terrible." And they have, you know. Then you say, "Well, have you been?" And they haven't, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like the Tracy Emin bed. People got outraged by that at a distance, you know,
from the Daily Mail.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. I want to know how you repaired the thing. How did you do that?
It took a while. Yes, it was a painstaking thing.
Six months?
It took less than 6 months. But actually, maybe a couple of months to kind of talk to people and talk. It was good. It's good if you have a sculpture that is so badly damaged to have the artist there to talk to. I mean, the fact that he came in and could give me his opinions on how he wanted it to look is incredibly important, because had it been a much older piece of art and the artist wasn't around, in a way you can undertake a more interventive treatment. And sometimes people do less restoration and they leave a little bit more of the mark of the damage there because they're worried that it's too interventive otherwise. But at least Alan wanted her to be completely repainted and possibly remade. And so we came to a sort of... Because the thing with conservation is that you're supposed to keep as much of the original material as you can. So we came to a compromise, and I just retouched the bits that were damaged.
Can I ask, you know, earlier that you said that a woman had said that she you know, held up her hands and said, I can't do it. Was that for political reasons, or she was just like, I don't know how to do it. Was it a technical thing?
She was made uncomfortable by it. I think she started off working on the figure. She was a conservator, and she started off working on the figure, and then she became more uncomfortable with it.
Mm. Could she rationalise that?
I don't think she could, and I think, to me, I tend to sort of get quite academic about all my projects, and I'm looking at the materials and how I'm going to solve the problem, and so I sort of zoom in that way. There are so many pieces of art where I suppose in theory you could get shocked and walk off the stage and go, no, I refuse. But I mean, I don't think Alan Jones's chair was one of them for me, but it's legitimate, I suppose, for people to do that. And there was another person who got some of the way there, but it was quite a tricky restoration, and he hadn't been brought in until I started it. So actually, I think his involvement was very helpful in making decisions, really.
You know, I know it must be distressing for any artist if their work's damaged, but I know from talking to him, and you must have heard this from him as well, how upset he was at seeing the work damaged. Yeah. He said it was like one of his children being hurt in some way. Yeah. I think it was a very painful thing for him to go through.
It was, yeah. And I think he was pleased to engage in it.
But I don't really think any piece of art, regardless of how offensive or whatever people see it as being, should be taken off the planet. I mean, I think these are people's comments, they're works of art, and that to me is like burning books, you know. Mm-hmm. Just because you disagree with it, you destroy it. Well, that seems like a very strange response.
Yeah.
I think, like, even these, like, restoration pictures are so interesting, and as we came, this one, it looks like a facial peel.
It does. Yes.
It's so interesting that, like, even the restoration is sort of going back to this perfect use of mannequin, and this kind of mannequin feminine perfection, because you've all been saying how universally how pretty she is and how appealing to women, and mannequins as being kind of objects that sell things to women, sell kind of aspiration to women, and it's kind of great to see this kind of facial peel that again kind of like sells a dream to women of sort of rebirth. And
that's a really interesting point.
Do you think that I was just thought of Pygmalion, you know, the sculptor, and then once you breathe life into her or something.
Yeah.
Just imagine, do you think that men think, ooh, if she'd only come to life? I'd love to ask the men here. Do they fantasize about these women coming to life?
Well, that goes back to Laura Mulvey's
comment. It does, exactly.
They would just be. That's the whole thing.
We were talking about the image of the face, the wrinkly paint, because to me it brings up the image of someone having one of those horrible acid attacks, you know, because that has happened.
Katie Piper. I mean, I can see at the time why it's really, you know, offensive to women at the time, where they were being portrayed, you know, I think in very limited ways. Mm-hmm. And then to, again, to be portrayed in a way that they're like, really, well, we've got to fight harder, and this is being revered as a piece of art. And I think now that we, you know, that you can undo the meaning of this. Like, S&M gear is incredibly long and difficult to get on. And so I think that the fact that she isn't nude, like classical art would, like the rogue be Venus, there shows, like this woman mentions here, because of the obvious BDSM, I think that people assume this is brutality, but you don't engage in this kind of activity without being a willing party to it. And I think that I think Alan Jones's portrayal of clothes and makeup through all of his work is an interesting subject in itself. The reason that he's used clothes at all and put underwear on her instead of exposing her backside like the rogue be Venus. You know, I came about looking at all of his images when I did my top five choice of the exhibition, and I thought, you know what, I see more of myself in his sculptures than I do in I don't know if I'm allowed to say it because it got cut from the blog. I called it classical fuck cushions. You know, like, you're just like some, like, submissive, like, sort of doughy, you know, always ready to receive. And these women aren't. They're challenging. It's like to get rubber knickers off. It's a whole. It would be a whole, you know, process.
They're being paid.
Sorry.
They're being paid. I get the feeling they're being paid.
Oh really? They're smart. So they're prostitutes.
And they're being paid a lot of money to get in these poses. Oh yeah. If you fantasize about them, there they are, the pose, and then they've got a belt around the chair thing. So you know, it's not. It's just been put there.
Well, so it couldn't possibly that. And then I think what I find a lot of people find hard to think about is that it's about female sexuality, that women like this.
Yeah.
I think that is more offensive to most people than any of it really. It's like what a woman would...
Dominatrix and all that sort of thing too. Look at the black boots. Apparently they were very hard to put on, you know. Did you read that?
They were very hard to put
on. Incredibly difficult to put on those little boots.
Only my boss, the head of sculpture conservation, could actually get those boots on because he had no, well, this particular one had no movable feet. So it's incredibly difficult to get them on. And, I mean, there was quite an element of comedy, really, with the struggling to get the boots back on and things.
Welcome to my career.
Yes, I know. Well, there you are. It's exactly what you were saying. But you're right. I think they were very long-winded. I can attest to that, to get on.
In terms of that taboo of like women liking this, it's interesting to consider Lars von Trier's like Volume 2 of Nymphomaniac, where it shows kind of Charlotte Gainsborough as a protagonist, as female protagonist, who actively goes and seeks out like BDSM and being in a passive position and kind of pursues it. And I think that was really kind of controversial, like today, just for like that's such a clear sort of portrayal of actually like female sexuality and actually women seeking out passivity, which is, to be passive.
Which I think is kind of hard for people to digest, especially when, you know, the new catchphrase that Cheryl Cole saying about being strong women. I hate the phrase strong woman because it just means absolute what muscular strong or, you know, it means nothing, but it's supposed to mean everything. And I think that there is a kind of strength in, there's very much a strength in Alan Jones women.
I think it's interesting, again, like situating it in kind of contemporary feminism, and so much of people's problem with the sculpture is that we perceive it to be degrading, but I think where feminism is today in terms of, the Lars von Trier, or say like Lena Dunham,
or the Secretary,
as perceiving it as taking ownership of what is seen as degrading and kind of to put themselves in their own in that situation.
Yeah, and when you think about when this work was made, as we've all talked about, this was not this particular pose, but the pretty woman, the pretty made up woman, always available, was kind of the ideal woman at the time, and there weren't that many alternatives that were as strongly promoted, so you can, it's, you know, it's very understandable. And and thinking about the feminist movement from the 70s, really, I would say through the 80s, which is my, you know, where my experience of it started, we weren't doing things like body protests or naked protests, which a lot of feminists are doing now to make their points. Events like Slut Walk are out there. And the issue of the body and bearing the body or displaying flesh wasn't a political issue in the same way that it is now, it seems to me, in terms of the form that protests are taking. And it's quite interesting to see that difference. And that, again, that's why I think most people in 1986 or in 1970 wouldn't necessarily know much about BDSM or understand, she's in a passive pose, etc. I think the dominant meanings were quite different in the first two decades of its life.
Yeah. So I suppose the whole connection with the sculpture and this feminist narrative, and whether people are offended by it. I mean, we're still talking about it now in terms of are people offended by it. But in a sense, is this completely irrelevant? Because it's not, it wasn't made to be offensive.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Alan Jones himself is deeply upset by this constant narrative about people being offended. He was very upset indeed with the inclusion of the sculpture in our exhibition Art Under Attack, because he didn't want people to be reminded of the fact that people had hated enough to attack it.
But the art is to provoke. You were saying that he's an incredibly intelligent man, so...
Yeah, and I think he's deliberately been ambiguous about what his purpose was behind the work. I mean, you can always say that artists don't own the content of their work.
But what he said was that he was sick of this constant negative narrative. and he wanted to get back to people understanding it as a work of art.
Of course, no, and I think, you know, in retrospect, you can see, and I think he sees himself, that in some ways those works have defined his career, and not in a particularly positive way. And one of the things we've tried to do in the exhibition here is put them in the context of his work, which, when you see them there, we hope that people will react to them in a slightly different way. We've separated them. They're not a unit.
But on the other hand, you can't divorce the controversy around the work because it's still present.
Yeah.
I mean, you said but there, you people who weren't going to come to work.
They're still very powerful works. One of the interesting moments we had at the beginning of the show, we were doing some press work with Channel 4, and they got Laura Mulvey in. Now, she was one of the people, one of the feminist commentators that talked about it in the 70s. And she was lovely, actually. I was very pleased to meet her. And I talked to her about it after she'd done her interview, and I said, well, how do you find it coming back and seeing it 40 years on? And she said, I find it just as strong. She said, I find it just as difficult. And I thought that was that was interesting. And to me, I read that as it's a very strong work of art.
And we can see that in its dissemination in other forms as well.
Also, he's a very young artist at the time. If you think about the young British artists and, you know, the splash they wanted, I mean, the show here, Sensation, with all those pieces of art that were so obviously just trying to...
The Chatham Brothers, and I find make those pieces far more sort of really
And of course, you know, they rely on Alan Jones. That part of the trajectory, and so is Sarah Lucas, and as you mentioned before, Jeff Koons. You know, they wouldn't. And yes, they are more shocking. They're more offensive.
I'd be intrigued to see how many of those works of art will endure as much as these will, though. I think that's quite interesting because I think some of them are. Some of the works that were in the Sensation show were fantastic, but some of them were about a shock factor, and once that's gone. You know, maybe there's not a massive amount left. But I do think when you're a young artist, you want to make a splash. So I do wonder if part of it was a...
Can I ask this lady, are you offended by the Barbie doll? That was invented in 1959, you know. I read the whole history of the Barbie doll.
No, just to be clear, I mean, we've been talking about the history of feminism. I was at university in the 70s. I went to work in the city in the late 70s, early 80s. Frankly, life is hard enough, you know. And I could just see this... We're surrounded, we're in a very convivial group here, it's been very... And please, you know, I also think feminism... I do think feminism is about choice. It's totally about choice. And whatever you want to do, you know, that's fine. That has always been fine with me. But if I think about my own life, and if I think about the city now, this image would be in a gallery, fine. But can you imagine this? You know, in the lobby of a...
It's all to do with context.
I suppose that's what I have so strongly in my mind, because I know that we're open-minded. But you show this to I don't know how many people outside the London intelligentsia. And you're going,
but what about magazines that young girls are reading now with images of themselves, which are...
Because I don't read magazines.
They are all... within the same context of female representation.
Sure.
I kind of think that there are the way that women are sold.
Oh, sure, pop stars and Cyrus and all. They idolise them.
But also, in a way that women are being refed images of themselves and how they're meant to be. I think that the difference between the passive and the strong. To strong women. I find shampoo adverts offensive. Yes. Not the way that I find this. I just find it's a ridiculous. Whereas this is a fantasy of, it's actually an idea. But what we're being sold is how you should be. I find that much more claustrophobic, much more dangerous, actually.
Yeah, but I think what you're suggesting, though, is the fact that, as we've all been discussing, that meanings lie in the mind of the beholder.
Well, I think there's a lot in that. Yeah. I think it's probably in part because of the way, because of timelines. I agree with, I think you said, Laura Mulvaney. I don't think the power of this image has in any way reduced. I think it's simply because. Yeah. Perhaps people, I don't know how many people know it, actually, and perhaps it's
people who don't know it, who have rediscovered it through the exhibition. But it's powerful. It is powerful.
I thought the point you raised was an incredibly interesting one, that, you know, when you it's fine art. That's what Alan has made it, as a work of fine art, and he's absolutely adamant about that. When you see it within the context of the exhibition, you get that. It makes sense. But take it away from that and put it in a place that's kind of, you know, you're talking about the city, somewhere that's very male-dominated, where women don't hold quite as powerful positions as the men, and it starts to have a much more uncomfortable presence.
I've been in that position working on sculptures where, you know, there'll be people sort of, you know, because you're suddenly taken outside that, and there'll be people leering or doing really sort of lewd things with the figures. And then it's quite true what you say, it's quite true, you take it out of its context, and I suddenly feel quite anxious because I'm suddenly in this place where people are.
Don't they use a similar in Clockwork Orange?
Can I just say that that's the thing about sculpture and objects, when you talk about Alan being upset about and surprised maybe that had been attacked, I was thinking that, you know, the difference between a figurative sculpture and a statue, in take it out of context and that disappears. And figurative objects provoke response, as you
of course, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that is bound to happen with something like that. So I think that idea that he's sort of sentimentally attached to it, I find that odd. You know? But of course you're going to provoke this object, and you know it, you know, whatever you might say. Mm-hmm. And also I find this idea that his work is pretty, I've got this issue with this, because I think they're really generic pictures of women. And I also think that Kate Moss thing, I find that offensive, not for all the reasons that you might think, but because of this fetishization of what a thigh's meant to look like, and how these figures, you know, this strong woman kind of idea. And they've all got the same body, haven't they? They've all got the same body. It's really bland. It's almost like nothingness.
I find the Kate Moss work really boring.
Boring.
And from the fashion, in coming with the fashion background, I'm sort of thinking, oh my God, Kate Moss is amazing. And I just find it, so I find that his weakest work as well, because he removes the fantasy of what a woman is and goes, this is Kate Moss. And you're like, it's like an advert. And I'm hoping that he's using all of those things.
Well, I think the photograph is the thing that works best.
Yes, yeah.
Because he wanted to take a photograph of her, and he's very good at photography, he's very good at lighting, of course, as most artists are. And he realised, actually, it would just look like a fashion shoot. And then he thought about putting the body on her, which is the classic Alan Jones body that he made in the 70s, and it becomes something else, and then she becomes an Alan Jones artwork. And I think that does work.
I think it's interesting, because I see the Kate Moss works as more leaning towards fantasy. And I think that's something that's kind of within all this kind of discussion, it's this distinction between the mundane, as you mentioned, and the kind of mythical. And I think we find, as a culture, kind of representations of women so much more palatable if they are framed in quite a fantastical, mythical way, like the Coons, and it's kind of this baroque, hyper-saturated in it, which I think we find that much less offensive.
Well, Kate Moss is almost like a mannequin of a woman anyway. She, you know, they're famously, she doesn't speak, she doesn't have opinions on things. And she has become, well, not publicly anyway. No.
She's incredible.
Yes, I'm sure she is. That's why she's so famous.
She's neither big nor little, nor she's looks kind of tall, but she's not really tall. She's incredible and very, very lovely. Yeah.
But do you think there's a kind of relationship between all of the women and then the Kate Moss? She's a mythical mannequin.
They're all ideal women.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she's culturally become this kind of goddess. Like I was thinking earlier, it just came to my mind, again, Kate Moss, the Mark Quinn, where she's in the kind of yoga. And that is such a kind of mythical image and stuff.
Well, it's also, you know, it's he's a pop artist. And I think that, you know, unlike all of the other people that came out of the Royal College in the 60s, he's remained true to that. Mm. And it's kind of obvious that he would work with someone who is such a pop icon. Mm-hmm. You know, they're kind of made for each other. It was just a matter of time before they got together and did something.
I put the Jeff Koons image in because I wanted to sort of just say that I thought that the chair had taken, he was so, I think he was very keen to take sculpture away from this traditional, very safe
very classical idea. Like when I first started working at the Tate, there's a very nice marble called Diana Wounded, and she's got a bandage around the top of her leg in exactly the place where a stocking top would be. But it's all clouded in this lovely Greek, you know, sort of, oh, well, it's classical, so it's okay. And she's marble, so it's okay. And she doesn't look like a real person. So we all like it. But and he was obviously trying to sort of break away from that completely, I think, with this work. But I think it's interesting that Jeff Koons then, in sort of riffing off him a great deal, I think, has then gone right back to the classical with this work, and has sort of gone right back to this sort of snaky classical sort of environment for this work. And again, the super real, the very sort of shocking reality.
But it's very true, you know, the idea of material, if this chair was all in bronze.
Yeah,
exactly. Find it the same in bronze. It would be, yeah.
Material and colour, the role that colour plays in sculpture, and it can change the reception of the work. Lindsay, did you ask that the Gibson was included? This is a sculpture by John Gibson called Tinted Venus from 1851 to 1856, which was controversial in its time because it wasn't completely left in its original material, marble. It was painted, bits of the body were painted. And
it goes back historically, because, I mean, that whole idea of people thinking that Greek sculpture was not painted for so long, because paint survived. So I suppose in this period of time when he made this, people suddenly discovered, oh, it was painted, and he made this. But there's this story that he had her in, I think she's got this really long date, 1851 to 1856, because he had her in his studio for a really long time and sort of fell in love with her. I find this whole idea of the artist sort of, you know, that she almost came alive. I find that a really sort of interesting idea, and very much relates to this kind of figure to me.
Why can't a woman be displayed in rubber knickers and it be powerful to a woman, rather than be displayed like this and it's pure? You know, why is there not a purity to the S&N, the bondage thing, about that process that you go through as a purification process? Why is it white marble skull, something like that is pure? She could be a whore for all we know.
We're about to wrap up here, and I just wanted to have one more question contribution.
It was just Lindsay said about the whole thing being like a mannequin. It reminded me of the film Mannequin.
Mm. And how that's based on Pygmalion as well.
Sort of like he didn't want to let it out for people to see it because he sort of fell in love with it, which is basically the whole story of the film. And it's sort of like, that's how I felt by looking at the chair. It's like, as they said down there, like a generic woman. It's just, you know it's a woman, but it doesn't hold you in the sense that you don't look at it and think, oh, that's me. It's just this generic, you know, mass-produced person that you see in shops and that kind of stuff. So it doesn't really...
The objectness of that and the sort of closed-offness of it. Yes, yes. Yeah.
Well, it's plain in that ready-made thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of art aesthetic.
Nobody's mentioned pornography.
We did talk about the label porn chair earlier, but we didn't get into it. We could have talked about all sorts of other things, but I think we've covered quite a lot, actually. Can I just thank our speakers here for making a provocative debate happen? Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.